From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Ford, Chrysler, and General Motors with hats in hands. Hello again, I'm Orrin Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Backed by organized labor, the CEOs of the Big Three want a federal bailout, but there's no consensus on how or whether to save them. Democrats, Republicans, and the Bush White House may let Barack Obama pick up the pieces, even though GM may go bankrupt before he takes office. With CEOs and labor leaders marching on Capitol Hill, we'll get a progress report. We'll also learn about Joe Lieberman's punishment for supporting John McCain. On Reporter's Notebook later on, pirates defy naval warships and seize their biggest prize yet off the Horn of Africa. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. The Big Three are launching a big push for a Washington bailout. If Democrats and Republicans can't resolve their differences, though, will the auto industry still be in business when the White House changes hands? We'll have that story today, and Democrats wrap Joe Lieberman's knuckles. On Reporter's Notebook, a giant oil tanker has been captured by pirates under the noses of the world's most powerful navies. First, this news update. The $700 billion bailout was known as TARP, the Troubled Asset Recovery Program. It's gone from buying the troubled assets of banks to buying part of the banks themselves. On Capitol Hill today, Treasurer Secretary Henry Paulson said he won't spend more than half of the money.
The prudent course at this time is to conserve the remaining funds available from the TARP, providing flexibility for this and the next administration.
Some congressmen are worried about that change from the troubled asset program to buying up the banks. Here's Elijah Cummings, a Democrat from Maryland.
We have learned now from what we've already seen that we have to have some pretty strict oversight. Mr. Paulson has disappointed a number of us.
Ryan Alexander is president of the nonpartisan group that calls itself Taxpayers for Common Sense. And Ryan Alexander, good to have you with us.
Thanks.
Tell us about this question of oversight and how Congress, even according to some of its own members, has failed in that regard.
I think there have been a number of different shortcomings in the oversight scheme. First, I think that the bill that created the bailout didn't have strong enough oversight provisions in it to begin with. It included one provision that was very strong for a special inspector general, but that special inspector general was just named last week, and he needs to be confirmed by the Senate. So we're several hundred billion dollars into this program, and we don't have probably the strongest oversight mechanism in place. There was a congressional oversight board that was supposed to report every 30 days on how the program was going, and Congress just named the first members of that last week after the first reporting deadline. And the administration, the principal or one of the principal mechanisms for the administration to provide oversight, the Financial Stability Oversight Board, is in many ways really just a working group of the cabinet members who are responsible for this program and for the economy. To call that an oversight mechanism that they're going to meet and make sure that they're being responsible for the economy, you know, that's what they should have been doing to begin with. It's the Secretary of the Treasury and the head of the Federal Reserve that this is what they're doing now. That was not additional oversight. So I think initially the bill was too weak, and Congress and the administration have been slow to act.
What does all this have to do then with restoring confidence in the economy and the fact that or the idea that the government has a handle on it?
Well, I think that, you know, we heard a lot about in September that there needed to be really swift action, and that was one of the reasons why this bill went through quickly, relatively quickly, and with with wide support, was that there was a sense that we needed quick action. The fact that that Congress didn't keep its part and move quickly to make sure that the Congress and the administration, that the oversight provisions were in place, I think doesn't help our efforts to restore confidence in the economy and make sure that there's real confidence that the government knows what it's doing in trying to shore up our financial systems.
What about the first $350 billion? Where has it gone?
It's mostly going to banks. When the bill was passed, the idea was that most of this money would be spent to acquire troubled assets, so mortgages and mortgage-backed securities that had, were sitting as big losses on different financial institutions' books. But in fact, what has happened is that most of this money has gone out the door just as a cash injection into banks. So the first $125 billion went to 9 different banks, and different $25 billion each to 4 large banks. That was to, in hopes of getting the credit markets moving again, although the federal government didn't require that the banks who agreed to take this money would start moving that money. We've seen a little loosening in the credit markets, but not necessarily because of that, not necessarily because of those injections.
Today, Sheila Bair of the FDIC said it's essential that some of the money from the bailout go to providing loan guarantees and credit enhancements to stem the flood of home foreclosures, but Treasury Secretary Paulson says no deal.
I think this is going to be a big battle in Congress and will be a big challenge for the next administration since there's resistance from the current administration. I think every member of Congress has people in their home districts that are experiencing foreclosure, so it's a real priority for people in Congress. Clearly, the collapse of the housing bubble is part of what stemmed and started the economic crisis we're all living through right now. So I think, Congress is going to keep pushing and something will happen, but how quickly, we don't know.
I saw on CNN, I believe you were on that program today, on that channel, report about a 2-page application that banks have to fill out to get money, just 2 pages?
Yes, it's just 2 pages.
You couldn't get a mortgage by filling out a 2-page application.
You couldn't get a mortgage, you couldn't get a student loan, you couldn't get a lot of things with just 2 pages. And, 1 page of it is basically for contact information. So, that's another thing that the Department of Treasury is working hard to restore confidence in the banking system, but they need to make sure that they're establishing confidence of the public and of Congress that they're doing the right thing and creating I'm all for streamlined paperwork, but that I think goes a little too far.
All right, Ryan Alexander, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
Again, President of Taxpayers for Common Sense. In a moment, Ford, Chrysler, and General Motors, all with hats in hands on To The Point.
To The Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Olney back with To The Point. The CEOs of the Big Three are putting the pressure on Democrats and Republicans. General Motors Acceptance Corporation is running full-page newspaper ads headlining "The Auto Industry Matters" and warning about the ripple effects if plants close and laid-off workers can't feed their families or pay their taxes. Here's Alan Mulally. He is the CEO of Ford on one of the morning talk shows.
We're in an economic situation now with the credit crisis and the financial and the banking issues that we really, more than ever, the automobile industry needs to be part of the solution. And the only thing that we're asking for is to set up a bridge loan mechanism that if the economy continues to deteriorate in the near term, that we could access that so we can continue to invest in the products that people really do want and value and help be part of this economic recovery.
Alan Mulally of Ford, he and the CEOs of GM and Chrysler are scheduled to testify on Capitol Hill, along with the auto workers president Ron Gettelfinger. David Shepardson is based in Washington for the Detroit News. And David, thanks a lot for taking the time to be with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
What do you think of the prospects at this point of there being a bailout?
Well, look, clearly today there was a lot of opposition from both Democrats and Republicans about the current Democratic proposal, which is to take $25 billion from the Wall Street Rescue Package you were just talking about, the $700 billion, and divert it into this bridge loan program, as Alan Mulally was talking about. The other alternative, which is what the White House wants to do, is convert the retooling program that was part of the CAFE increases, that $25 billion, drop the fuel efficiency requirements and turn that into a program where the automakers could use it to pay their bills as they face a very tough economy.
So those are the two proposals, and it does not appear that the twain will meet on those.
Well, exactly, because the way it works is, the Republicans are supporting dropping the strings from the retooling money. A lot of Democrats want to use the TARP money. And at this point, there doesn't seem to be a good compromise between the two. The other thing is, this is a lame duck session of Congress. They're only supposed to be here for a few days. It's very difficult to get anything done without overwhelming support. And I talked to Senator Feinstein earlier today, and she said she doesn't think that there are the 60 votes there to pass to end the filibuster and move to a vote on this.
Dianne Feinstein, Democrat from California. What are the consequences, according to the auto companies, if they don't get the bailout before the end of the year?
Well, I mean, things are pretty dire for the automakers. GM and Ford lost or burned through $14 billion in cash in the third quarter in a three-month period combined. Each company was burning through more than $2 billion a month, one because of the dramatic decline in auto sales this year, but also because they've seen a rapid shift from smaller cars, from SUVs. And, of course, Detroit has made most of its money on SUVs and pickup trucks over the last 10 years.
And, of course, a lot of people say that's their own fault, that they didn't get ahead of the game like the Japanese manufacturers did and provide cars that are fuel efficient.
Well, I mean, there's no question that Detroit couldn't figure out how to make money on small cars. I mean, the average price of a Honda Civic versus a comparable American car is $5,000 or $6,000 more. I mean, Toyota and Honda have figured out how to sell people small cars and make money on it. And Detroit has largely made its profits from larger vehicles. And, you know, clearly, you know, as the market shifts towards small cars, Detroit has to figure out how to make more money and sell more small and mid-sized cars.
There are some that are saying that bankruptcy would be a better way to go than a bailout, because it would force them to reorganize, perhaps get rid of some of the managers and go forward into the future.
I mean, I've heard that argument, but I do think the automakers make a strong argument, which is that people do buy an airline ticket from a bankrupt airline because they're only making a $300 investment that they're going to use up in the next few weeks. Will people buy a car when you have so many choices from a bankrupt company if you're worried about your warranty being honored, whether there will be spare parts, whether the company will be around to, you know, conduct recalls? So I do think it's a harder sell for a consumer to buy from a bankrupt company. Now, some have talked about some government overseeing, you know, or sanctioned bankruptcy, you know, as one possibility. Clearly, they need to do restructuring, whether it comes more restructuring, whether it's in bankruptcy or out of bankruptcy, they have to take more difficult actions to return to profitability.
David Shepardson, again, based in Washington for the Detroit News. I know you're on the way to one of the hearings, and thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Okay. Harley Shaken is a professor at the University of California in Berkeley. He specializes in labor and the global economy. And Professor Shaken, welcome to you.
It's good to be here.
There was a bailout once before, the Chrysler bailout. Tell us what happened then.
Well, that happened in 1979, and in a lot of ways, the situation was quite similar for Chrysler. A sudden shift in the market, the company was the weakest of the automakers, and it began sliding very rapidly towards bankruptcy. In this case, there was a fierce debate in the Congress, but ultimately the Congress felt Chrysler was too large, too linked to the rest of the economy to let fail, and that the devastation in Michigan in general, Detroit in particular, would be astounding, costly in dollar terms, devastating in human terms. So the government authorized $1.5 billion in loan guarantees.
Sounds like peanuts these days.
Right. It does, but if you adjust it for inflation, it's still real money, just
okay.
Very small, rounding errors in our current environment. But the net result was they had 10 years to pay it off. They paid the loan off 7 years early, that is after 3 years. The government made about over $300 million on the deal, and Chrysler survived as a healthy company for a decade and a half later.
Did it survive as a healthy company, or was the inevitable postponed, as some people say?
No, not at all. Chrysler in the 80s gave us the minivan. Its models were selling very briskly. It was known as a very innovative company when it came to its engineering. What really began Chrysler's heavy downward slide is the so-called merger of equals in 1998 with the German company Daimler, that is the parent of Mercedes. That was more an acquisition than a merger, and Daimler essentially gutted Chrysler's engineering and made some very poor choices that led us, at least for Chrysler, where we are today.
One of the other big differences, of course, is the presence of the foreign automakers in this country, particularly in states like Alabama, where they are going away, building cars with non-union shops. One of the senators, Republican senators, most opposed to any kind of bailout of the big three is Senator Shelby of Alabama. There's some conflicts of interest shaping up here?
Oh, sure. I mean, certainly Senator Shelby's ideology is very clear. No government role. But if you look a little closer, what he means is no government role to the competitors of Mercedes, Hyundai, and Honda, all of which have major operations in Alabama. The state of Alabama gave tens of millions of dollars more than any of its competitors to attract these companies. A Honda training center alone, the state funded for $30 million. That's a pretty significant government role. So the ideology's real, but it rings a bit hollow when you look at what took place on a state level in Alabama.
Really makes things very complicated. Again, Professor Harley Shaken is at the University of California in Berkeley. Darrell Samuelson is senior reporter for Environment and Energy Daily. And Darren, thank you very much for being on our program.
Happy to be here.
One of the issues involved here has to do with the White House proposal, as we heard earlier, to convert $25 billion already appropriated by Congress to help the auto companies develop better fuel efficiency. Now the Republicans want, as I say, to convert that. What's your objection to that proposal?
Well, not so much an objection for me. I'm the reporter who's covering this.
Sure,
but
okay.
The objections that you're hearing, you know, are that this money shouldn't, you know, be directed, pulled out of the bigger financial bailout that Congress passed not too long ago. But, you know, the push here is to try and get these auto companies to try and, you know, produce cleaner, fuel-efficient cars, meet the, you know, the fuel efficiency standards that were enacted into law in 2007. That's one of the things, at least from the environmentalist perspective, one of the groups that I'm covering. They would like to see the automakers, as they're getting this money, getting sort of restructured, they would like to see this money go toward, you know, meeting, you know, the first kind of changes in fuel economy in decades. And they'd also like to see them back down from some of their opposition they've had on greenhouse gas emission standards, whether it be California trying to implement its standards, which are some of the first in the nation to try and reduce greenhouse gas emissions, or the efforts to try and create some national standards.
Thank you for clarifying your position. I didn't mean to suggest that you are an advocate for the people that you you have to report on. So if, in fact, this $25 billion were converted to just try to keep them in business, it would be sort of a free ride from the standpoint of the environmentalists who think that finally we have the leverage to get them to change their ways.
That's right. I mean, it took many, many years and many, many attempts to try and get the increase in corporate average fuel economy standards through enacted in a law that President Bush signed in 2008. It was the first real major energy push that the Democrats were able to accomplish. Probably one of the biggest accomplishments that you could say from the last Congress, or from the Congress that's wrapping up right now. So you have this big victory that the environmentalists had been pushing for, and it was a bipartisan coalition in some respects that got that bill across to the finish line eventually. So they don't want to give on that, and they're hoping the domestic manufacturers can meet those standards.
Darren Samuelson with Environment and Energy Daily. Harley Shaken, back to you, professor at UC Berkeley. What about the idea of using this crisis for the auto industry as an opportunity to change them, change the management, to change the fuel efficiency requirements, and make them more competitive, is the argument.
Oh, I think this crisis can serve exactly that role. In fact, the auto industry right now does get it. But this is a very difficult industry to turn around, given how capital intensive it is. All of the automakers are bringing out significantly more fuel-efficient cars next year, but all of them also have hybrids or plug-in hybrids in the works in the next 2 years. It's going to take a lot of money, and those programs need to be accelerated. That will benefit all of us, and I think that's what's critical here. This is an opportunity for better fuel efficiency, for less carbon pollution out of the new vehicles, for the industry to do something that is really very belated, but the fact that it's engaged now is vital, I think, for the economy and for the environment.
Darren Samuelson, back to you. Another opportunity or possible opportunity, potential opportunity, is being seized by one of the Democrats, Henry Waxman of Los Angeles, to take over a chairmanship from John Dingell, who comes from Detroit, who's been very important in this industry. How does this battle within the Congress reflect the kinds of changes that might be going on in the auto industry?
It's pretty amazing. This is a battle that nobody really expected, until the moment that Waxman announced his bid, and it came hours after Obama won the presidency. It was the Wednesday after the election. Some see it as a move by Waxman, the challenger, to really try and just get a shot across the bow on a whole front of issues, whether it be healthcare, which is another big issue that's in front of this committee, the auto industry, environmental regulations, energy regulations, and global warming. So. Henry Waxman really is just making a play for everything that is before this very, very important committee's jurisdiction.
But you've been told by Barney Frank, very important player in all of this, a Democratic congressman from Massachusetts, that one of the people who wants to push environmental fuel efficiency standards, that he's not going to vote for Henry Waxman. How come?
That's right. I mean, there's a lot of members. Barney Frank was someone I spoke with yesterday. Just in the last hour, I had a chance to talk to Charlie Rangel, the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, and he's also voting for John Dingell. There's a whole host of reasons why John Dingell is getting support, and it's primarily, he's the dean of the House of Representatives. He's been in Congress. He was just reelected for his 28th term, so 56 years. He's 82 years old. He's from Dearborn, Michigan. He represents sort of, the history of this institution, and seniority rules in a lot of respects here in Congress, and, to just bump somebody off in terms of seniority, at least for someone like Barney Frank or for someone like Charlie Rangel, who also have chairmanships, you start doing that, then I think that at least the very important senior members of Congress probably don't like the idea of other people nipping at their buds. So, that's one thing that's going on here. And then there's an ideological issue, whether or not whoever wins this battle will be in charge pretty much of moving Obama's energy and environmental agendas forward on Capitol Hill in the House. And, if it's Dingell does represent, I think, a more moderate perspective. He would probably be a little bit more of a coalition builder. He's very accomplished in doing legislation. For Henry Waxman, he's definitely seen as more of a liberal who would probably be pushing from the left. So, you definitely have an ideological split here in terms of who wins this battle.
So, Professor Shakin, very quickly, we've only got 30 seconds left. A lot of complexities in this that have to do with much more than just the automobile industry.
Absolutely. What we're talking about is the state of the economy and the impact of failure here would have on employment and economic health. Voting no on this, in effect, is an anti-stimulus package when it comes to the economy.
Harley Shakin again, a professor at the University of California at Berkeley. Darren Samuelson with Environment and Energy Daily. Thanks very much to both of you. We'll come back, talk a little bit more about changes in the Congress, particularly regarding Joe Lieberman on Reporter's Notebook. We'll talk about the fact that warships from the navies of the world couldn't stop a piracy off Africa on To the Point.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
We're only back with To the Point. Connecticut Senator Joe Lieberman was the Democratic candidate for vice president in the year 2000. In 2006, he lost his party's primary, but he was reelected as an independent. Democrats kept him as chair of the Committee on Homeland Security, but this year, Lieberman was one of John McCain's most prominent supporters, and that led to calls for punishment. Today, the Democratic caucus gave him a break. Here's Majority Leader Harry Reid.
First of all, let me say that I pretty well understand anger. I would defy anyone to be more angry than I was. But I also believe that if you look at the problems we face as a nation, is this a time we walk out of here saying, boy, did we get even?
In short, Lieberman gets to keep his chairmanship. Here's Lieberman's reaction.
Some of the statements, some of the things that people have said I said about Senator Obama are simply not true. There are other statements that I made that I wish I had made more clearly. And there are some that I made that I wish I had not made at all.
And obviously in the heat of campaigns, that happens to all of us, but I regret that. And now it's time to move on.
Time to move on, once again, with the chairmanship. Jane Hampshire is a liberal blogger. She is the founder of FireDogLake.com. And, Jane, good to have you back on our program.
Hi, Warren. Good to be here.
All right. What's your reaction to this?
Well, I think that trying to attribute this to revenge is a straw man. I think that people were really upset with Joe Lieberman and the job he did as chairman of the Homeland Security Committee. Joe Lieberman politicized that position. For instance, when the Hurricane Katrina happened, it was his committee's job to look into what happened. And after his, which he promised to do, and after his election in 2006 with the help of the Republicans, he abandoned that on their behalf. So Joe didn't do a very good job as the chairman. He protected the Bush administration. He kept the Senate from looking into corruption and graft and theft. His counterpart committee in the House actually recently found that there was $15 billion worth of corrupt contracts in the Homeland Security Committee. And Joe, frankly, refused to look into that. So our objection to Joe at being the head of this committee had more to do with the fact that he wasn't doing his job than partisan politics. It was the Democrats who turned it into a partisan issue and made it about who they liked and who they supported. And I think in the end, what they did was they voted to protect their own.
What about the statements he just referred to himself, Senator Lieberman just referred to, that he made about Barack Obama? He said some of the things attributed to him weren't true. Some he wished he had been more clear about. Others he wished he had never said in the first place. They certainly didn't sound like the statements of a Democrat, did they?
Well, Joe also refused to say when pressed what those statements were that he never made. Others have documented quite clearly with YouTube video clips and audio everything that Joe said, so I defy him to find something that he was accused of doing by any reliable blogger or news source that weren't documentable.
What's an example? What's the worst thing he said, do you think?
Well, he accused Barack Obama of not standing with the troops. When Barack Obama was called a Marxist, Joe said that that was a very good question. He said that Barack Obama was Hamas's favorite candidate and that that was an important distinction between him and John McCain. And all those things are on videotape. Joe can't take those back. He can't pretend like he didn't say them in the era of YouTube. They were very much macaca moments.
So two elements involved then here. On the one hand, according to you, a bad performance as chair of the committee that he's going to be able to keep. But secondly, there was a partisan issue as well, which I take it you think is, you said it wasn't, the Democrats made it the issue. Nonetheless, it would be a legitimate one from their point of view, wouldn't it?
We've been lobbying for Joe's removal from this committee ever since 2006 when he decided he wasn't going to investigate Katrina. That has had nothing, the election and what happened with Barack Obama hadn't even happened at that point. So that may have been what alarmed a lot of people, but that wasn't what we were originally upset about.
What does it say about the Democratic leadership in the Senate that they chose by a vote that was not publicized in a private meeting where apparently a lot of words were exchanged, that they still gave him his chairmanship?
Well, I think that they're very much missing what people voted for this time. What they voted for was change, and they voted for change that wants oversight, that wants people to meaningfully look into all the waste and graft that's been going on over the past 8 years, that wants people to be held accountable for what they did, and wants us to change going forward. They didn't vote for an old boys club that protects its own, and I think that this decision shows that which side the Senate came down on, that they haven't quite got the message yet.
All right, Jane Hampshire, again, a liberal blogger, founder of FireDogLake.com. Good to have you on our program.
Thanks so much, Warren.
Ed Kilgore is managing editor of the Democratic Strategist, formerly policy director for the Centrist Democratic Leadership Council, a centrist organization very much involved with Joe Lieberman when he was a Democrat before he became an independent and certainly before he supported John McCain. Ed Kilgore, good to have you with us.
Thanks, Warren.
In the interests, as Senator Reid has it, of not being angry, not taking revenge, do you think the Democratic caucus did the right thing?
No, I don't. I definitely don't. I would come out where Jane has ultimately, but for different reasons.
I think that Joe Lieberman, in endorsing John McCain, in campaigning for him, in criticizing Barack Obama, crossed the line you simply cannot cross if you want to call yourself a Democrat. The last time a sitting member of Congress in either party endorsed the other party's presidential candidate and did not lose their seniority was in 1956 with Adam Clayton Powell. And since he was the only African-American member of Congress at that point, you can sort of understand why he might have been given a pass. I really don't understand why Joe Lieberman has. And, you know, for those who argue that this is some sort of outreach, a way to show that this is a big tent Democratic Party, I think that's exactly wrong. Of all the people that should be offended by this, probably the most are those hundreds and thousands of moderate to conservative Democrats in the past and in the present who have had differences with their presidential candidates in the national party but did not cross this line. The idea that this would be that stripping Joe Lieberman at least of his committee chairmanship would be an act of vengeance strikes me as getting the offense wrong. He chose to do this, understanding the implications. So I'm pretty upset about it. Obviously, there Barack Obama, Democrats in Congress, and the country as a whole have bigger fish to fry. So I'll register my complaint, but don't plan to obsess about it.
Ed Kilgore, managing editor of the Democratic Strategist. Jamie Kirchick is an assistant editor at the New Republic, has a different view of all this. Jamie Kirchick, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
You've thought or indicated that you thought they ought to keep him on as the chair of the Homeland Security Committee. How come?
Well, for several reasons. One is from a strategic standpoint. I don't understand who this would please, kicking him off, who that would please other than angry bloggers. They were the only people calling for this. And you saw by the vote, it was a 42-13 vote. The only senator willing to come out publicly and call for stripping him of his chairmanship was Pat Leahy, and then Bernie Sanders, who's not even a member of the Democratic Party. He's a socialist. So strategically, I think this is a very good sign that the Democrats are sending, that they're a Big Ten party, that Barack Obama's promises to unite the nation and to put aside the partisan bickering that people are understandably sick of, he's going to sweep that away. I don't think President Obama would want to deal with a fight on Capitol Hill, with all this drama on Capitol Hill in the first weeks of his after having won the election. And I also think Joe Lieberman has been instrumental also in Homeland Security. He's one of the people who created this department. He's an expert on the subject. And I also think he represents an important strain in Democratic Party thinking. He's really one of the last Scoop Jackson Democrats. He parted with his party on one issue, which is the Iraq War, and I think he had the correct reasons for doing it. And I think there are people who sympathize with the positions that he takes. And while they might not have agreed with him endorsing John McCain, I don't think it was that outlandish of a choice that he made.
Okay, two issues now. Once again, one has to do with the presidential candidacy, the other with the running of the committee.
Right.
Let's go first to the presidential candidacy. If he said that Barack Obama wasn't standing up for the troops, if he said that he was a Marxist, if he said that he was...
whole Marxist thing, Ms. Hampshire brought this up, and I think your listeners should know that in 2006, Ms. Hampshire, doctored a photo of Joe Lieberman in blackface during that primary election campaign.
Okay, well, so she's not here, so let's not...
Let's talk about the Marxist thing, okay? If you actually go online, your listeners can listen to this themselves. He was actually asked, do you think he's an elitist like Hillary Clinton says he is? And it was in response to that part of the question that he chuckled and said, that's a good question. And then he went on to further elaborate, I think Obama's very smart and a good guy. Most of these things that have been said about Joe Lieberman by individuals like Ms. Hampshire and other angry bloggers are just not true. And that's
We got Ed Kilgore on here, and he's an angry Democrat. What about saying that Obama was the candidate of Hamas? Jamie Kirchick.
He didn't say that either. He didn't say that. He was asked about the fact that Hamas had endorsed Obama, and he said that there was a difference between that would show the difference between McCain and Obama on the Middle East. I mean, certainly, if President Bush had been endorsed by the Saudi monarch or General Musharraf, I'm sure individuals like Ms. Hampshire and other liberal writers and journalists would be making hay out of that. So, if a terrorist group is going to endorse a presidential candidate and Joe Lieberman is asked about it and he says, well, Let's ask why. Why is Hamas endorsing him? I don't see what's wrong with that.
Okay. I think I may have distorted what Ms. Hampshire said myself. I believe she said exactly as you did, described exactly as you did, the way that the issue of Hamas came up. Let me go back to Ed Kilgore. Do you think that he really said these things or that he got close enough at least, which was the way you phrased it, that he really crossed a line?
Well, first of all, I think he pretty faithfully echoed Republican talking points, McCain-Palin talking points about Barack Obama, beginning, middle, and end. I think the broader question here is, does he really represent a significant number of rank-and-file Democrats? I don't think he does in any significant way. I mean, he represents a point of view in some think tanks and in the chattering classes, but he pretty much is sui generis. But again, I'll just say it again. He crossed a line that you may not cross in either party by endorsing the opposition party's presidential candidate, campaigning actively for them, criticizing, however you characterize these criticisms of the Democratic nominee. It's a form of self-exile. Again, I'll emphasize this. There are a lot of people with a lot more moderate to conservative Democratic views than Joe Lieberman who have never taken this step. Blanche Lincoln didn't do this. Mark Pryor didn't do this. The idea that Joe Lieberman somehow represents anyone who considers themselves a moderate to conservative Democrat simply isn't true. And again, for decades, there have been Southern and Western Democrats who didn't necessarily agree with their national party or presidential candidate, and they did not take this step. It is the one thing, the one irreducible minimum we require of people if they want to call themselves Democrats. Joe Lieberman knowingly violated that, and yes, it does concern me that he's going to get away with it, and what that means for people in the future who are wondering why they should bother to exhibit any sort of party loyalty.
So, Jamie Churchick, what about that? These others who did exhibit party loyalty held their noses, as it were, and either didn't come out against the candidate or supported him.
Sure. I mean, I would say Lieberman, of course, is in a special case, which is that he ran in 2006 for re-election. He lost the Democratic primary to Ned Lamont, and then he won as an independent Democrat pretty substantially with, 10% of the vote. So, he was not he caucused with the Democrats, but he wasn't really technically a Democrat. He's an independent. So I think that, less ought to have been expected from him in the 2008 presidential race than you would expect from the many more conservative Democrats in Congress. And I also would question whether or not, yes, Joe Lieberman endorsed the Republican nominee, but I would say that there are other Democrats in Congress who have certainly frustrated progressive goals far more than Joe Lieberman has. I mean, you can look at Robert Byrd, who's the outgoing chairman of the Appropriations Committee, who for decades has been the biggest shill for the coal industry. And I think he's, hurt the values and the policies of people on the liberal side of the aisle far more than what Joe Lieberman did in endorsing John McCain. You don't see people calling for his head in the same way.
So, Ed Kilgore, back to you. What about that frustrating party goals? That's a pretty important point, and certainly some moderate to conservative Democrats have done that when there have been liberal Democrats in office and as candidates for office. Where do you draw this line?
Well, I disagree with the premise. I think Jamie's trying to change the subject. The question here is not, what are the ideological outlines of what's acceptable behavior for a Democratic senator? It's what's the absolute minimum you can expect for someone who wants to call themselves a Democrat or independent Democrat, or however Joe Lieberman's defining himself this week. The irreducible minimum is you do not cross the line and campaign for candidates of the other party, particularly in a presidential election. And again, I have to stress how much precedent there is behind this and how many people, and by the way, I would dispute the idea that people like Mark Pryor and Blanche Lincoln were holding their noses. I think they did support Barack Obama. My simple point is this: the claim that somehow giving Joe Lieberman a pass on the one absolute minimum requirement to call yourself any sort of Democrat is somehow going to be signal a big tent party or encourage moderates in the Democratic Party, I think is completely backwards. it lets those people down. It lets down the people in the Democratic caucus with less seniority than Joe Lieberman, who lose a step here. And by the way, the idea that this somehow has anything to do with reaching with postpartisanship or putting the election behind us or reaching out to Republicans gets the question wrong, too. Barack Obama and Harry Reid, for that matter, can reach across party lines when they want to. This isn't a question of reaching out. They could reach out to Joe Lieberman if we were in the Republican caucus. It's a question of what absolute minimum requirements there are to call yourself any kind of Democrat. And I think Joe Lieberman knowingly crossed that line, and it's going to be a tough line to reestablish in the future now.
Jamie Kirchick, we have 30 seconds left. Have you ever known of a Republican get away with this?
Not to my knowledge. I'm not a historian, and Ed probably knows a lot more about this than I do, although did Lincoln Chafee endorse Bush in 2004? I think he did.
Okay, good question.
I don't know.
Ed, have there been any Republicans that have gotten away with this?
The situation was in 1964 when a lot of moderate Republicans didn't support Barry Goldwater, but not a single one of them endorsed Lyndon Johnson, much less went out and campaigned for him. And again, that's the line we're talking about. You know, it's one thing to withhold support. It's another altogether to throw your support to the other side, particularly in as aggressive a way as Joe Lieberman managed to do.
Okay. Ed Kilgore, once again, managing editor of the Democratic Strategist, Jamie Kirchick, assistant editor at the New Republic. Thanks, both of you, for being with us. The chairman of America's Joint Chiefs of Staff said he is stunned by the latest act of piracy in the Indian Ocean. An oil tanker as long as 3 football fields has been seized off the coast of Africa and anchored near Somalia. More on that in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Werman Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. After Somalian pirates seized a Ukrainian ship loaded with weapons, the U.S., Russia, and the European Union all sent warships to patrol the Indian Ocean. That was in September. Now, despite their presence, a much larger ship has been taken much further offshore. Borzu Daragahi reports for the Los Angeles Times. And Borzu, good to have you back on our program.
It's my pleasure.
Let's first describe the Sirius Star, the ship that was taken. How big is it? Who owns it? And what was in it?
Well, this was a huge, very large crude oil carrier, which is about 1,000 feet long, about the size of a U.S. aircraft carrier, and it contained up to 2 million barrels of oil. That's about $100 million worth of crude oil. It was way out in the in international waters, 420 nautical miles, according to the U.S. military, when it was approached by pirates, apparently from Somalia, who apparently swarmed it and took it over and have now taken it and anchored it off the coast of a Somali area known as a haven for pirates.
Is there any indication, any evidence that these warships that were there had any knowledge that this was going on and tried to stop it?
There is no indication to that effect. As a matter of fact, the U.S. military has said, the commander of the 5th Fleet in Bahrain has warned merchant ships in the region that the allied military forces cannot be everywhere at all times, and that they must be pretty much that the ships should look out for their own security. And he made a very good point. He said that, you know, the companies wouldn't even think like for a second about leaving $100 million worth of loot unguarded on land. So why do they think about doing that even at all out in sea?
Well, apparently they didn't expect it. Here's Michael Mullen, the Navy Admiral, chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, says he's stunned by this.
I think he was stunned by the audacity of this particular pirate attack. It showed a level of organization and cunning. You know, these are not like Captain Ahab, with a parrot on his shoulder. These are very much like organized criminal gangs with satellite equipment, with machine guns, and what they do is they organize into 4 or 5 groups of 4 to 6 armed gunmen with high-speed inflatable rafts, and they essentially just overpower these ships with gunfire, board them, and then take them over.
So this, I gather what you're saying is that the ships themselves then don't have any way to defend themselves. They don't have their own armed people on board to fire at these people and keep them off?
Well, this is the thing. A lot of these ships are operating. Not only do they not have armed people on board, but they're operating with very, very small crews. Like this particular ship, the Sirius Star, although it's very huge, it's almost completely operated by computers and very sophisticated GPS, global positioning system equipment, in which basically they can run on their own. And so they have very small crews to reduce costs. And subsequently, sometimes what one expert told me is that they'll designate the cook as the ship's security officer in order to cut down on costs. And so they won't have any kind of real security detail. Now, one important point with an oil tanker or a tanker carrying chemicals or liquefied natural gas, gunfire is out of the question. You don't want to be firing weapons on a ship of that kind, even if you're defending yourself. But what one security expert suggested to me is simple water cannons.
Oh, that's an interesting idea. And I would think you're talking about cost, but if you got $100 million worth of oil on board, you'd be willing to buy some water cannons.
You would think so, yeah. Or at least have a security detail, have crews that are trained in taking evasive maneuvers, although with a ship of this size, it takes like a half an hour just to slow it down a little bit. So you're not going to be able to take quick evasive maneuvers.
Now, with the earlier ship, the Ukrainian ship that had the weapons on board, it appeared that what the pirates were interested in was not so much the weapons, they were heavy weapons, but rather the crew, and they want ransom for the crew. Is that likely to be the same situation here?
I think it probably will be, and oftentimes they want ransom not just for the crew, they want it for the ship. They try to get a package together where they try to get money for the crew, the ship, the cargo, anything they can get their hands on. This is becoming a real problem, a real issue. You had this incident on Saturday with the Sirius Star, and then just today there was another ship that was hijacked off of the waters of Somalia, a ship called the Delight, a Hong Kong flagship that was heading to Iran with what some describe many tons of wheat, and this was also taken over, and they're trying to figure out how to get this one back as well.
Well, once this ransom has been paid, wouldn't it be discouraging to further pirates if the warships, for example, or somebody just took these people out as they were leaving with the ransom money? Is that kind of thing likely to go on or in the future?
I don't think that has happened at this point. The best way that the security experts and military people that I've talked to that you can fight piracy is by fending it off at the point of attack, so that you would have the kind of system in place where they will not be able to successfully take over a ship. Mm-hmm. At this point, and the other kind of very, very more fundamental suggestion is land-based solutions so that these pirates don't have a haven. Right now, the big problem, the reason why you've had this increase in piracy is because of the situation in Somalia. This is a very weak central government that is facing an insurgency by Islamist radicals. It's basically not even able to take control of the capital, much less the seas off of its shores.
And maybe this question answers itself when they went to 429 nautical miles offshore, but is it absolutely necessary to use these particular sea lanes in order to conduct commercial shipping? Could the ships go someplace else by some other route?
Well, you know, no one has said this yet because we don't have enough information, but maybe one of the reasons why they were going so far away from the shore was to avoid exactly this sort of scenario, because usually the incidents take place within 200 nautical miles of the shore, and so maybe they thought that they were so far out in the open seas that they would not be threatened by pirates. Obviously, they were wrong.
So does it appear that the government of Somalia, such as it is, just allows this to happen, or does it actually encourage it? Is it part of the government's way of staying in power?
I think that's a good question. I'm sure there are elements within the so-called Somali government, which is a fractured and fragmented entity that is under a lot of attack and is broke and unable to keep control of its own country, that are in league with the pirates. But the Somali government, the officials, the parliament, parliamentarians, they say that, look, you know, we're a poor country. We don't have the resources. If you want us to stop piracy, you have to help us. That's what they're saying to the West.
Middle East correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Usually you're talking about security in the desert. Now you're talking about security on the high seas. Kind of a difference for you.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's kind of interesting, but you know, this is an issue that affects the Persian Gulf, which is part of the Middle East that I cover as well.
Borju Daragahi, Middle East correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks a lot for being with us. Today's program produced by Katie Cooper with Andrea Brody and Francis Anderton. Our technical director is Mike Newport. You can email us at kcrw.com/to the point, and you can share your thoughts on our comment page, same address, kcrw.com/to the point. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.